Buffalo can hang on. This is going to be a good one.
The fans at Kansas Speedway know how to have a good time. And you are all invited. NASCAR weekend at Kansas Speedway, May 4th and 5th. Get your tickets now at kansasspeedway.com.
Welcome back here in the program here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Soren Petro with you, and let's talk a little football. One of the leagues that I enjoyed more than I think anybody on earth, except for the guy that's on the other end of our Sprint guest line. He is the author of the new book. It is called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Anyone who's listened to the program knows my passion for the USFL, but in talking with Jeff over the years, I think you might be the only guy that enjoyed this league more than me, if that was possible. Thanks for giving us some time today, Jeff. We appreciate the time. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I like talking to anyone who likes the USFL.
Yeah, exactly. I'm always curious, and we talked to you about your last book. What was the inspiration? I mean, you love the league. You make that clear in the foreword of the book. But what made you say, okay, I think there is a book here and one to write?
I always thought there was a book. It was more a matter of getting a deal. It's been 10 years of trying to get a book deal, and 10 years of me telling people how great the league is, how rich the stories are, how big the names are. And it's actually funny. It had nothing to do with Donald Trump, who owned the New Jersey Generals. When I pitched his book, he wasn't even a part of the pitch. I know I'd be writing about him, but it wasn't. You know, there was no appeal. There was no thought, oh, you really have to get Trump in there because, you know, he's going to be president one day. To me, it was just an exciting, fun, thrilling, groundbreaking, trendsetting football league that really had some preposterous stories inside of it.
But President Trump, then just Donald Trump, does figure prominently in the league. And that's one of the things that I learned from this book. I mean, having lived through it and been a guy who, you know, a kid or whatever, would have been 14, 15, 13. I can't remember the age range I would have been, but right in there, watching it, I remember Donald Trump owning the Generals. I did not realize he initially backed out of the league. Like, if you'd asked me who owned the Generals the whole time, I'd have told you Donald Trump. And that's some of the great stuff in the book is the things that went on behind the scenes of the league are amazing. And were you surprised when you dug in, or was that part of what you were looking for in the story was the way the ownerships bounced around? I mean, as a kid, I was just into the players and the stats and the games. But, you know, now as an adult and understanding how leagues work and all the behind-the-scenes stuff, it's fascinating to hear how he initially just bailed on the league, hung up the phone on their first conference call, and walked away before eventually coming back. Did you know all that when you started down this path?
The thing about writing a book is they always want a proposal at first. So you hand in a proposal, and it's all nonsense because what you really do is you learn stuff from researching. So you can say, oh, this book is going to be about this and about that, but I interviewed 430 people for this book after handing in the proposal. So everything changes. So I knew the skeletal sort of build of the league. I knew Donald Trump. I did not know that when the league started, he was listed as the owner of the New Jersey franchise. And one day they held a meeting, an owner's meeting in San Francisco, and it was a really big, important one of the early meetings. And they're all waiting for Donald Trump, waiting. And the phone rings, and they answer, and they put it on speaker, and it's basically, hey, this is Donald. Yeah, so I'm not doing it. I don't think I'm going to do it. Okay, good luck to everyone. Click. And there's just this utter shock in the room because you need a New York, New Jersey franchise, especially back then. So there's like a weird, there's a weird group of owners. There were some really financially stable owners. There were guys like Trump who really wanted an NFL team and saw the USFL as a way to get one. There were guys who could not afford to pay their bills. The owner of the Chicago Blitz was a guy named James Hoffman. This is in 1984, the second season. And after one of the games, he was walking off the field with a player named Dan Jiggetts, and he said to Dan, he's like, yeah, I think I'm out of here. And Jiggett said, oh, where are you going? And he's like, no, I'm out of here. I'm done with this team. I'm just done. I don't want to do this anymore. And he basically dumped the team and the USFL had to take over. I mean, left on the side of the road. I've never heard of an owner doing that before or since. So there's a wide range of crazy.
Could the league have succeeded? That's one of the things. And in the book, it's detailed. And we're talking to Jeff Perlman. He's the author of Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. He's a best-selling author on the New York Times list and has written Gunslinger about Brett Favre, The Bad Guys Won. All his books are very good. I think I've read almost all of your books, if not all of them.
Thank you.
You bet. And I love this one. Love the subject matter on this one. Could the league, and you detail about how Donald Trump immediately came in and a lot like he seems to do things today, would say whatever's on his mind. Like, I didn't know the part about Lawrence Taylor. I'd forgotten about him going after Lawrence Taylor and getting him signed and actually giving him $1 million to come play. And it was all supposed to be on the hush-hush, but he immediately, he called as himself and you know, or called as someone else, but it was himself, and put the story out there that Lawrence Taylor was going to sign, and he created this fake PR guy that did this, but it was actually him on the phone, right?
Yeah, so he it is kind of fun. I mean, the book isn't about modern times, but it is funny researching a book like this, seeing that fake news hashtag. He literally invented a publicist. And it was him. His publisher's name was John Barron, which is funny because he has a kid named Barron now. And he would call and spread news on behalf of Mr. Trump. And it was him calling using a fake voice. You know, hey, if you really want to speak to Mr. Trump, I can probably get him on the line and have him talk to you if you'd like. Oh, that'd be great. And then 10 minutes later, you're talking to Donald Trump, not knowing you had already talked to Donald Trump. And he would do that kind of stuff all the time. So he really wanted the USFL was a spring football league, and he really wanted to go to fall. So he started telling the other owners that he had these great conversations with the network heads, and they all want fall. They all love the idea of fall football, and it's definitely can happen, and I can get a great TV deal. Well, no such thing had taken place. Not even close. And when later on the TV guys from ABC and NBC were asked about these conversations, they said, yeah, we spoke to Donald Trump, but we told him we didn't want fall TV. But he kept telling the other owners, no, Fox TV is looking great. He really had this idea in his head that he could push the USFL to fall, and the NFL eventually would be forced to absorb a bunch of the teams, and naturally his team would be one of them because the Jets had just moved to New Jersey to join the Giants there, so he saw this big opening in the New York metropolitan market, and he thought he could fill it.
So how was he able to basically wrest control of the league away? Like, were they just asleep at the wheel? Because, you know, he goes from ditching the league at their first meeting, right, where he doesn't show up, and as you said, he clicks off on a conference call and says, I'm out, comes back in, buys the team from a rich Oklahoma oil guy who's like, listen, it's too far away, and he actually made a profit, right, on his deal, one of the handful of people that did. But how is he able to get control of these guys, and I get it that some of the guys weren't rich, but other guys were powerful guys, and he ends up just grabbing the wheel and running away with the league. How did that happen?
It's actually pretty remarkable. A big part is the sheer force power of his personality and of repeating things over and over and over again and not taking no for an answer. I mean, some of the executives with the leagues I interviewed just recalled this sort of whirling dervish who would not take no for an answer, no matter what. And, you know, they hired a firm to do a $600,000. This is a league that was not rolling in money, and they paid $600,000 to have this sort of information service firm go out and determine whether the USFL should move to fall and what should happen. And all the owners agreed to put in money for the study. And the study came back very conclusively against moving to fall, that it would be a terrible idea. Well, as soon as the study came back, Trump was the first one in the room to say, this is nonsense. These people don't know what they're talking about. I know fall is going to work. I've already gotten the TV, we've already got that ball rolling. And the other thing is that the league kind of was handcuffed a little bit because the L.A. franchise wasn't working out. The Chicago franchise definitely wasn't working out. The Washington franchise had been a disaster. New York was really the big market they had left, and they had it in their TV deal with they had deals with ABC and ESPN, and in the TV deal it said the USFL had to have markets in Chicago and New York. Those were required markets. Well, Chicago just died, and here's the owner of the New York market. So he had a lot more power than the other owners based on geography alone.
Okay. We're talking to Jeff Perlman. Football for a Buck is his new book. Could, if the league stays in the spring, would it have made it?
That's a tough question. I think ultimately a bunch of teams would have been absorbed because, you know, it played its last season in 1985. In 1987, you had the player strike in the NFL where they brought in all the replacement players. A lot of the owners look back and they see that and they think, damn, if we had held out a little longer, there would have been a mass exodus of players to the USFL. There would have been utter chaos in professional football. And they think, and I think too, markets like the Jacksonville Bulls, the Memphis Showboats, maybe the Birmingham Stallions, the Oakland Invaders, the Baltimore Stars, those teams would have been appealing to the NFL. Those were empty markets at the time. So I don't think we'd be talking about the USFL as an independent spring league in 2018. I think we would have had several of the franchises in the NFL.
And that is the legacy of the league, is it not? That in addition to still having the best instant replay rules around where the coach had to challenge, and if you didn't have a timeout, you couldn't challenge. If you lost your challenge, you lost your timeout. Still to this day, I can't figure out how they don't just do that in the NFL, the way they bog down the games in college and NFL football right now. But in addition to some innovations that they had along those lines, that was their legacy, was showing that Jacksonville could work as a football market. Oakland was still a viable market. I know the Raiders have returned and now gone back, but football could work in Tennessee. Baltimore got its team. The NFL, they basically did just follow the path of the USFL and go back and grab those markets in later years. I mean, that is kind of the legacy of the league, is it not?
You know, I think there are a couple. I think, yes, I agree with you. I also think the legacy is that you saw a huge, huge, huge uptick in salaries for football players at the time because suddenly the NFL was bidding against someone. And if you look at the salaries now, there's a direct line to the mid-'80s when the NFL started paying big money for players. I also think you look, the USFL produced four NFL Hall of Famers, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, Reggie White, Gary Zimmerman. Almost 200 players jumped from the USFL to the NFL. And I always say, I was watching a tape of the Redskins-Broncos Super Bowl not that long ago,
yeah.
And Doug Williams threw four touchdown passes in that game. Doug Williams played for the Oklahoma Outlaws in the USFL. He threw one to Calvin Bryant of the Philadelphia Stars, one to Ricky Sanders of the Houston Gamblers, and one to Gary Clark of the Jacksonville Bulls. The USFL was all over that league, and the impact was so much bigger than people now realize.
And not to mention, and maybe from an on-the-field standpoint, I know people scoffed at it, and still to this day, it's funny to hear people scoff at the run-and-shoot offense that was run by the Houston Gamblers and Jim Kelly, and they were just absolutely fantastic and a great team to watch. And the Houston Oilers would adopt the offense and run it in the NFL and put up big numbers with Warren Moon and have great success there. But those concepts of what they did in the run and shoot are employed today. I mean, that was the advancement, really. The way the AFL advanced throwing the football and going after the quarterbacks and driving the salaries, just as you talked about with the USFL, the USFL also, in addition to driving the salaries, advanced the passing game. And what we watch today, a lot of it was going on back then in the USFL.
No, I agree with you 100%. And the other thing that's interesting is USFL, this was a weird time period in football when you're generally African-American quarterbacks coming out of college were being switched in the NFL were being switched to defensive backs and to cornerbacks and to wide receivers. And USFL was letting black quarterbacks be black quarterbacks. Walter Lewis out of Alabama, Reggie Collier out of Southern Miss. The list goes on and on and on. They also took a guy, you know, Doug Williams always felt that he was not treated well by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And at the time, I think he was around the 48th highest paid quarterback in the NFL, which is absolutely crazy. The Oklahoma Outlaws came along and said, we respect you and we appreciate you, and we're going to pay you big money if you want to play here. And it was the first time he felt respected, just as an African-American in football, certainly as a quarterback. So the USFL also was a very open-minded league. They liked the players also promoting themselves. They liked on-field celebrations. They promoted the league really well with a lot of crazy promotions. It was a great blur of lightning that happened very quickly, and you know
it was fantastic in history. You know, Herschel Walker knocking down the got to be a senior to enter the draft rule that came from the USFL and changed how college football and the NFL work together right now with it. That's detailed in the book. The incredible contract that Steve Young signs coming out of BYU, his 40-year deal with the LA Express, is amazing. And I did not realize, and maybe it's just because I was a kid, I didn't realize how cocaine, alcohol, prostitutes, and any other vice you could possibly think of were running rampant around professional sports. Like, being in Kansas City, I remember we had a very big baseball case that involved Willie Akins and a number of other Royals. So you kind of knew what was going on. But when you, first of all, how open were the guys in just telling you some of the stories of what was going on behind the scenes with these teams?
Well, I mean, some were very open. Some guys view it. I mean, there was one guy, here's where you know you're just doing well as a reporter. There's a guy named Jim Bob Morris on these San Antonio Gunslingers. This isn't drugs. This is just sort of sex and weird. And he had a girlfriend who would fly in from Kansas to visit him. But he was having so much sex as a football player in San Antonio that he installed a second answering machine and brought this contractor in to put it in his wall. So when his girlfriend was there visiting, she wouldn't hear that people were leaving messages. And then when she left, he could open up a compartment in his wall and hear the messages from all the women to make sure not to miss their calls. There's a guy, Richard Johnson, on the Houston Gamblers, who later on played very well, actually, for the Detroit Lions. He used to smoke a joint before every single game because he said it would relax him. And he had a teammate named Vince Corvo, another receiver, who wasn't nearly as good. And he tried smoking pot before one game just because he saw how much it helped Richard Johnson. And he told me he was on the field just overcome by pure paranoia after smoking this joint, the first joint he'd ever smoked before a game. You know, looking at a football, why is it so big? Why are my hands tingling? Is everyone staring at me? They must know. They have to know. You know, the strength coach of the Houston Gamblers was a guy named Bob Young, and he didn't just request that his offensive lineman use steroids. He insisted it as a, you know, if you were going to play offensive line for the Gamblers, you had to use steroids. There's just tons. I mean, Chuck Clanton of the Birmingham Stallions told me basically his entire team went to a Coke party and snorted Coke the night before a game in San Antonio. And San Antonio was an awful team. And the next day, I think the Birmingham Stallions lost like 10-7 because all the guys were just exhausted from a Coke party the night before. So there's a ton. It was the 80s. There was excess. It was, you know, just, it was the USFL. It was very typical of that league.
We're talking to Jeff Perlman, and he's got another great book that's out. No doubt will be another one of the bestsellers. It's called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. My last question before I give you a quick final four, and that is, will we ever see a rival league again? Are there any seeds there for a league to rise up? Will we ever see, and you detail very well the case and the legal battle that they actually won and, of course, only got their dollar tripled to $3, which took away all the money. But they were found, you know, the NFL was found to be a monopoly. Do you think we'll ever see a challenge to any professional league that changes the laws, and will there be another football league that you know, at least competes with the NFL?
I think it's unlikely. I mean, never's a long time, so certainly, or ever's a long time, so certainly something could come along. The problem is all these leagues are so entrenched now, even way more than they were in the 80s. If you think about the power of the NFL now compared to what it was then, you think about the number of days it's on, you think about having its own TV network and the marketing. There are two leagues coming along, you know, the XFL and the Alliance, but they're not really rivals. You know, I think if one of their players is signed by an NFL team, they'll celebrate it. They won't feel threatened. So I think it's very unlikely in the near future that a league comes along to challenge any of these leagues. They're just too entrenched.
All right, we're talking to Jeff Perlman, great author, and the book is called Football for a Buck. Look for it if you're a football fan. You'll absolutely love it. Great stories on Carl Peterson as well and how great he was personnel-wise with the Stars. I could talk to you for about 3 hours, Jeff, but I know you've got other people I'm sure to talk to, so I will not go down that road, but great stuff. You'll see all kinds of names you recognize in the book. It'll be a great read if you get it, and you can get it where all the books are sold. Four quickies for you, Jeff. And I'll start you with this.
Okay.
Who was the greatest player in USFL history in your mind?
I say Sam Mills. There are three candidates, Kelvin Bryant, Herschel Walker, Sam Mills. But you just talked about Carl Peterson. I mean, real quick, Sam Mills was a linebacker. You know, he went on to a near Hall of Fame career in the NFL. When the USFL came along, he'd been cut by the Toronto Argonauts at the CFL, cut by the Cleveland Browns at the NFL. He was teaching photography at East Orange High School in New Jersey. And Peterson got a call one day from Sam Ratigliano, the coach of the Cleveland Browns, and said, you know, we cut this linebacker recently. He's only 5'9". you're going to see him and you're not going to want him because you're going to think he's too short. You got to see him in pads. Make sure you see him in pads. So Peterson and Jim Moore, the coach of the Stars, agreed. And I think Sam Mills goes down as one of the great middle linebackers in the history of pro football.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It is a great story. They shows up in big glasses, you know, studious, looking at the, who the hell is this guy? What's going on?
All right.
What was your favorite team? Did you have a favorite team in the USFL?
I did, actually. It's kind of funny. I do blame Donald Trump for ruining the USFL. At the same time, I was a huge New Jersey Generals fan when I was a kid. And if you look specifically just at him as an owner, forget what he did to the league. Just think as a Generals, he was paying these guys a lot of money. He was bringing in huge names from, you know, he didn't bring in Herschel Walker. He was there the year before, but he brought in Flutie. He brought in Brian Sipe. He brought in Gary Barbaro, Kansas City Chief, brought in a lot of guys. And the players loved him because he treated them well, and he paid big money because he wanted an NFL team, so he wasn't going to skimp about it. So while a lot of players on a lot of teams weren't getting paid, Donald Trump was always paying his players, and he was putting on a really good product on the field. So I was a huge Generals fan.
All right. Will the Raiders succeed in Las Vegas? Oakland figures prominently in this book, and the Raiders coming and going. Do you think they'll be a success in Las Vegas?
I think they will because they'll be making a lot of money off of different revenue sources. However, I once covered the AAA World Series for Sports Illustrated years ago, twice actually, in Las Vegas. It's a hard town to draw. There's just a lot to do in a very small area. And I think if that team struggles, I think people are going to ask themselves, why the heck am I going to spend X amount of money to go watch my crappy football team? So when they're rolling along, I guess they'll do okay. I think they're going to struggle with attendance more than people might think.
All right, and finally, your next book is what?
Oh, I don't know yet.
You don't?
If you have a good idea, I'm in. I have some ideas, but nothing definitive, to be honest.
Okay, nothing you're pitching?
I mean, I have stuff I'm pitching, but I'm really guarded about these things. My dream book, I'll tell you, is a biography of Tupac, the rapper Tupac Shakur. But that's a tough one to get to.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That would be awesome. Well, listen, Jeff, you write it, I'll read it. That's pretty much my rule. This book is fantastic. I loved it. We talked a couple of years ago when you were putting this thing together, and I'm thrilled that it's come out. You did a great job, as always. And thanks for giving us some time. I hope everybody goes out and buys the book because it's a really fun read. And look forward to talking to you on down the road, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.